I'm Steve Meyer of the Discovery Institute.
Paul Nelson, also of the Discovery Institute.
Doug Ax, Director of Biologic Institute.
And I'm Omar Nasser from Rational Religion. We've got three of the main proponents of intelligent design in the room with us. We're very grateful that they could make the time for us. We wanted to give you guys a flavor of what intelligent design is and how it may be compatible with your worldview, or if it's not, for you to explore intelligent design in a way that you may not have done before. I want to sort of start with the more basic questions around the issue. So, Steve, if you could just give me a brief sketch of what intelligent design actually is, what the theory states.
Sure. Let's start with a basic definition that we often use. Intelligent design is the idea or theory that there are certain features of the universe and of living systems that are best explained by a designing intelligence rather than an undirected process such as mutation and natural selection.
How does intelligent design differ from, say, creationism?
Intelligent design as a mode of reasoning, as a way of thinking about the world, really belongs to the whole of humanity. In fact, you can find it in, I think, all of the world's great philosophies and religions. Ancient Greek philosophy was characterized by debates between defenders of a view that mind or intellect was primary in the universe versus the view that matter or the physical world was primary. And that's not tied to any particular religious viewpoint. Creationism, properly understood, is the attempt to reconcile science, empirical science, with some sacred text. So in my background, that would be the first 11 chapters of Genesis. How do those sacred writings fit in, if they do, with the findings of science? So creationism has much more of a theological aspect to it. And for that reason, it is much more particular. It's not universal the way that intelligent design is.
Thanks very much. And how has the history of intelligent design progressed over the last 50, 60 years? Has the case been strengthened by any new data?
Yes, I would say that it has, quite dramatically. So particularly in the last, say, 30 years, where we started to get information on gene sequences and protein sequences. So in that time period, beginning in the 1980s, say, or late 1970s, it became possible to look at the complexity of molecules that function inside cells, genes that encode proteins, and to start to ask whether these informational molecules are tolerant of changes to their sequence, and if they are, how tolerant, and if they aren't very tolerant, how much information is contained in one of these things. It's taken many years and many people looking at these things to try to put numbers on that, but those numbers have come out in recent years. I've put a number on the fraction of possible protein sequences that can fold and function the way they have to inside cells, and it turns out to be an extraordinarily small fraction, one in 100 trillion, 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 which is not an easy target to hit. Those numbers could not have been, although I think if you go all the way back, when people look at living things, they would say that looks like it's been engineered, that looks like it's been made. It's only relatively recently that we could put numbers on probabilities. So that has changed the argument, I think.
It might be good just to piggyback on Doug's answer first, because the trend line in modern science, first in cosmology in the early 20th century, then in physics in the 1960s and 70s, and then in biology from the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, right up to the present, I think has been one in which more and more evidence is coming to light that points to a mind-first rather than a matter-first view of reality. In cosmology, you had the discovery that the universe has a definite beginning. In physics, the discovery that from the beginning, the physical laws and constants of physics have been finely tuned to allow for the possibility of life. And then in biology, and the area that Doug has done so much research, you have the discovery of a molecule that contains digital code, which is necessary for the production of all these proteins and protein machines. So we have nanomachinery, we have information processing technology inside cells, all on a miniaturized scale. It's an exquisite level of engineering design on display, and I think it really has put the issue of intelligent design, as opposed to just the Darwinian idea of apparent or the design or the illusion of design, back on the table. So the science, I think, has been trending away from the strict materialist view of the 19th century to a view that I think really needs to be open to the idea of agency or intelligence as being behind what we're seeing in the physical world.
Just to say that when you look at living things in particular superficially, you may not perceive just how sophisticated they are. And I think the natural world is one in which the deeper you look at cells, the more you find, as Steve indicated, levels of sophisticated coding and engineering that someone can spend their entire life solving. So when I first met Doug, it was here in Cambridge in 1992, and he was working on research involving these long information-bearing chains and how they're expressed as protein. But the first time we met, he gave us a primer. Steve and I were there, a primer on the motor that drives the bacterial flagellum. And he gave this wonderful talk. It was very informal, but we came to the end, and Doug basically said, this could never have happened by an undirected process. It's simply irrational to think that it could, in light of what I've said. Where do we go from here? So I think intelligent design comes to a place where we say, it's irrational to ascribe this level of sophisticated biological engineering basically to chance. Where do we go from here? So what encourages me is we are heading in the direction of new discoveries, new findings based on the premise that there was a mind behind the universe.
I remember when we started exploring your literature and we came across, for instance, your work on trying to produce novel protein folds by chance and going from one protein which is functionally different to another protein, but they have similar structures. Even the mutations required to get from A to B is essentially prohibitive if you have a chance-based mechanism. And we sort of wondered, well, where do they go from this? What do the Darwinists say to that? Do they just say you've forged your evidence? Do they say there's some kind of other mechanism which we haven't thought of? I mean, what I'm asking is it the exception or is it the norm? And if it's the norm, how do they deal with it?
They ignore it. Well, to some extent, that's the case. So the 2004 JMB paper that I had published put a number on the rarity of functional protein sequences, and that number was that scary number. There hasn't been, so far as I'm aware, there hasn't been in the literature a response that said, no, that's not correct. And it would be hard to do because there was other literature that was pointing to that scary sort of number anyway. So I really confirmed something more rigorously that was already there. There are people, though, on blogs who will say, it's not that hard, you can get a functional protein, they're 1 in 30 or something like that. You won't get serious people who work in the field that say that because it's a silly thing to say. And I can't respond to all the blog people. On the A to B transition,
you shouldn't even try.
Yeah, sometimes you just let it go. On the A to B transitions, interestingly, we have combed the literature. I should say, before Anne and I started working on the A to B, we were very open to the possibility that it would actually work. And in fact, we thought if we can get this to work, it'd be a really cool paper because we show how long it would take in the wild, but we did it in the lab. We found that it wouldn't work. We couldn't get it to work, and we found that the change is so complicated that it would never happen in the wild. Nor could we find any convincing case in the literature of an A to B that would work other than an A that already does B to a small extent. And that we didn't want to look at that case. So those cases do work. So we have an absence of any literature that confirms something that's thought to be a universal explanation for how you get protein diversity, which is a severe problem. We anticipated a complaint, and we thought we staved it off in the paper that describes this. The complaint that we anticipated was, someone will say, when we show this A cannot evolve this, the function of this B in even billions of years, someone will say, no one said that that was the source of the B that you're looking at. The B came from some other prior source. And so in our discussion, we said, or even in the introduction, we said, we're not looking at historical transitions here. We're asking the more general question, can enzymes acquire new functions under selective pressure to acquire new functions? And if they can't, or if in an ideal case, a very favorable case, we can show that it can't happen, then we've undercut the whole that whole explanatory framework, and that's what we think we have. What have they said in response? They have said that A, you picked the wrong system, that A did not evolve into that B, and furthermore, by looking at modern enzymes, you're looking at things that are locked in, they're so perfected by natural selection that they can't evolve anymore. So, and we thought that's a remarkable change of tactic, because it's effectively saying evolution does not work. They're conceding that in the present tense, evolution does not work, but claiming that it did work on some special things that nobody can find. And if we tried to find them and they didn't work, they'd say you didn't find the right thing. So it becomes, it really isolates the theory from any sort of testing at all, which we think shows that it's become a desperate theory.
It's frustrating to have all the interesting evolution be put out of sight in the past, because that renders, as Doug has said, renders the theory invulnerable to ordinary testing. And I think many evolutionary biologists are troubled by that. And we had just attended a meeting from the Royal Society where one of the issues that came up is we being the evolutionary biology community, needs to demonstrate how these transitions occurred. And an unwillingness to rely on magical processes in the past that you can't directly observe.
One of the things I like about Doug's experiment is that it, I think it's lights out for the Neo-Darwinists, because they scoured the database, the protein databases, looking for proteins that were very closely aligned. They have the same fold structure, and they looked for things that were very similar and found the best case. And they couldn't make this transition work for the best case scenario. The fundamental unit of biological innovation is a protein fold, and that's way beyond what can be plausibly demonstrated in a reasonable time frame. So if you can't get the molecular Darwinism mechanism to generate even a new protein fold, how are you're gonna generate the more fundamental innovations in form and structure? Can't do the small thing, you're not going to do the big things. So I think it's been a very powerful line of research that Doug has done with Ann Gager, and I think it's sort of thrown down the gauntlet. And as far as we can see, no one's really picked it up yet.
One thing that confuses me is that why hasn't the whole evolutionary biology field accepted your results? Because I thought scientists were supposed to be perfectly rational beings.
They're perfectly human beings.
Right.
And it's human to be committed to a worldview or a philosophy despite contrary evidence. And I think the commitment on the part of many evolutionary biologists is not really to the theory. It's rather to an underlying philosophy that says, when we explain the world, we can only use natural laws and chance processes, sometimes known as materialism or naturalism. Now, that is a much more fundamental commitment, because you end up interpreting the evidence in the light of that lens, or through that lens. And I think, having been at this for 30 years, that's much more challenging, because scientific evidence we can weigh, right? A philosophy, especially if you're fundamentally committed to it, that's much more challenging. So I think we need to be honest about where the conflict really lies. And I think scientifically, yes, of course, there are disputes. But someone committed to a worldview in which intelligence or mind first has been categorically excluded it's hard to reason with that person.
I would just add that that's one element of it. I think it's a little more complicated in that I suspect it's a fraction of the life science community and the scientific community that's actually committed to materialism. It might be a small-ish fraction, but a very vocal, very powerful fraction that has somehow got control of the academy. And maybe a larger fraction is not philosophically under that umbrella, but they're afraid of the implications of falling out of line with it. So it's really one of these sort of political things where one view has become the powerful view, and if you care about your career, you will not rock the boat, fall out of line with respect to that view. I think that's the situation.
Just to start bringing it to a close, sort of a final question before I talk about sort of some of the work that you've done more recently with your books. Do you think it's realistic for the scientific community to accept intelligent design when society as a whole increasingly doesn't believe in a designer?
I'm not sure I agree with the premise of the question, because polling data indicate, for many younger people especially, that they don't believe that they are strictly physical systems. In other words, they say, I'm spiritual, I might not be religious, right? But in my experience, interacting with all kinds of audiences, people recognize the reality of their own causality, of their own agency, and they are unwilling to surrender that and turn themselves into strictly physical systems. And I think that provides a way to engage in dialogue and say, look, you know that you can bring about effects that are real, that exist in the world, that are explained only really by reference to your unique personality. So I think I'm somewhat more optimistic that the reality of consciousness, the reality of agency, and when that's coupled with the shortcomings of the naturalistic view of science, creates great promise for intelligent design.
I'm reminded of a study that argued, it was published, it argued that stunning nature documentaries are bad for science. And what they really found was that when people watch these documentaries, even if they describe themselves as atheists, they are more inclined, after looking at them, to ascribe some sort of direction or purpose or intentionality to life. So I found it very humorous. The interpretation was that's bad for science, whereas actually it's bad for materialism. So I think actually there is a broad openness to something that looks a lot like design, even among people who don't describe themselves as theists, even among people who describe themselves as atheists or agnostics, which is interesting.
Doug, I understand you've written a new book. Could you tell us a bit about that book?
Having become very convinced myself that the Darwinian explanation does not work, and published papers along the way in peer-reviewed scientific journals, I wanted, with the opportunity to write a book, not to speak to scientists, but to speak to everyone, including scientists. And so I thought the best way to do that was not to simplify a scientific technical argument, but rather to recognize that at root, in its most basic elements, this is not a technical argument. In its most basic form, there is a strong intuition and there is basic reasoning that I call common science. It's common sense and ordinary observation, everyday observation, that confirms this intuition that life is designed. So I wrote the book around, starting with the intuition, observing that everyone has it, and this is broadly acknowledged, and then using simple, everyday sort of evidence to show that it's actually correct. And then also weaving in these scientific studies that confirm it. So in other words, at the end of the day, I end up saying the four-year-olds were right, and I spent 25 years in a lab showing that the four-year-olds were right. That's the kind of book.
Stephen, I understand you've had a book, Darwin's Doubt, and before that, Signature in the Cell. What are the sort of, what different areas do they focus on?
Both books are concerned with the fundamental problem of the origin of information and what the discovery of information tells us properly about the origin of life or the origin of new forms of animal life. The first book was about the origin of the first life. Second book was about the origin of the animal, the first animals in an event in the history of life known as the Cambrian explosion. And I examined the problems that information causes for evolutionary theories, and then in both cases argue that it's better explained, the origin of information necessary to build life or necessary to build new animals is better explained by a designing intelligence because of what we know from our uniform and repeated experience, namely that information, especially in a digital or alphabetic form, always arises from an intelligent source. So I'm appealing to our uniform and repeated experience of cause and effect, which is a properly scientific thing to do, but it's also, as Doug says, part of our ordinary reasoning. And so our conclusion of design is supported by our best science and our common sense reasoning.
Paul, just to finally wrap up, do you have any message to people who are maybe in the research world in the life sciences who see evidence for design but feel a bit trapped in their current situation?
Yes, get in touch with us. We know how difficult it is, and we'll protect your privacy, but there's a wonderful network forming of like-minded thinkers from philosophy to theology to science, even to politics and cultural studies. And we all have a stake in this, right? And one of the great things about the internet is you can have an invisible college. You don't have to be in the same room. You don't have to be in the same building. You can be, as is the case, all over the world, interacting on a daily basis. So there are plenty of ways of joining the community, being productive, and it's a tremendous amount of fun. That's the secret that we share, right? That actually this is really fun, and I look forward to going to work every day.
Well, that's all we have today. Let us know what you think in the comments below, and if you want more dialogue and debate around the existence of God, make sure to subscribe below.
Subscribe below.
Welcome back. You're watching the 700 Club. We've got a fascinating guest coming up right now. Hugh Ross was 8 years old when he started saving money to buy a telescope. When he finally looked through the lens, he was amazed at the beauty of the universe. Today, he's still looking at the stars, and he says they help prove the existence of a creator.
When Dr. Hugh Ross was a young boy, he was fascinated with astronomy. Hugh read every physics book in the school library by the time he was 7. As a teen, he was convinced the Big Bang Theory was the only explanation for the origin of life, until he picked up the Bible. Since then, Dr. Ross has been providing scientific evidence of a purpose-filled universe and explains recent discoveries in his updated book, The Creator and the Cosmos.
Well, join us for more is Dr. Hugh Ross. We welcome him back to the 700 Club. Hugh, it's good to see you. Thank you. I read this book of yours. It is encyclopedic in your knowledge of everything. But let me ask you something. How big is this universe?
Well, it's about 50 billion trillion stars. Well, those stars make up a quarter of a percent of the universe.
50 billion trillion stars.
Give or take a few billion.
Okay. 50 billion trillion, and that makes a quarter of the universe?
A quarter of a percent.
Quarter of a percent. What's the rest of it, dark matter? The
rest of it's dark matter and dark energy.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Well, now, you know, where are we? How big is this Earth the planet we're on compared to that?
Well, it's a tiny speck. I mean, our planet's only 8,000 miles in diameter. And the universe is, you know, billions of light years across.
Your book basically said that God, the Creator, made all that trillions of stuff out there to support this tiny little planet we're on.
It wouldn't be a planet Earth if the universe wasn't exactly that size. Make it bigger or smaller, you don't get life. It's got to be exactly that size.
Exactly that size?
Yeah, given the laws of physics, the mass of the universe must be exquisitely fine-tuned. The dark energy has to be fine-tuned even more. In fact, that ranks as the most spectacular fine-tuning design we can measure anywhere in science.
Well, I mean, you and I are sitting here on television talking about this, and is it all based for us? I mean, are we the pinnacle of God's creation?
We are the whole universe, literally every component of the universe, every event in the history of the universe must be exactly the way it is in order for billions of human beings to be living in a situation where they can be redeemed from their sin. The whole universe is designed with redemption in mind. I mean, if you look at the Bible, it tells us God begins his works of redemption before he creates anything. So every part of God's creation is for the purpose of our redemption.
Every part of God. So we are
every life form, every component of the earth.
Well, I noticed in your book you talk about all these elements. What are these elements and why are they so important? All these elements that if we had them, we didn't have them, what does it have to do with us?
Well, the mass of the universe must be exquisitely fine-tuned to get 94 naturally existing elements in the periodic table. And yeah, we need every one of them for advanced light to be possible.
Why? Why do we need them?
Well, I mean, your body, for example, has 22 elements in it.
Okay.
And many of those elements are what we call vital poisons. Mm-hmm. If you got too much in your body, they will kill you. Mm-hmm. If you got too few in your body, it will kill you. They have to be exactly at the right level. And we happen to be living on the one body in the universe where everything is exactly at the right level.
Well, now, there are people who, you know, believe that the Bible, that the universe is 6,000 years old because of Usher's dating. How old is the universe according to scientific knowledge?
We now know it to four places, the decimal, 13.79 billion, plus or minus 0.05. 13.79. Yeah, I tell a story there how we're now able to measure it very accurately. The Earth's age, we can measure to five places the decimal. So
how do we get such fine tuning on? I mean, 13 billion years, how is that so fine tuned?
Well, like with the thing about, we happen to be living at the right time in the history of the universe, where we can see all of the history of the universe. If we were created earlier, we'd only be seeing part of the history of the universe. If we were created later, we'd only be seeing part. We're at that one time where we can actually see the entire history of the universe and directly witness the cosmic creation event.
How do we see that? I mean, the Hubble?
Well, the velocity of light. It takes, so when we look at a distant galaxy, we're not seeing it as it is now, we're seeing as it was when light left that galaxy. Well, we can now look so far away, we can actually watch the universe being created. We can actually get data from our telescopes that tells us the conditions of the universe when it was 100 billionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second old. That's so close we can get to the cosmic beginning.
Say that again, a billion.
If we can get to within 100 billionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second. There's a whole chapter in this book on how we're able to do that.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, and so, it's direct observations. We're not inferring it. We're directly seeing it.
We're seeing it. Oh, that's unbelievable.
Well, it's our ability to witness the cosmic creation event, which gives us such compelling proof that, indeed, we live in a universe created by God.
We live on a planet that's in a solar system that's part of a galaxy called the Milky Way. And that, in turn, is part of a spiral nebula. Tell us about that. I mean, how does that all work so we can see from where we sit the rest of it?
Well, we happen to not only live at the right time to witness the whole history of the universe. We're in the best possible place to see the whole history of the universe. We're far from the galactic center, which means we don't get blinded by the light of the bright stars there. We're halfway between two spiral arms, which again gives us a clear view of the heavens. And we happen to be living in a cluster of galaxies where there are no giant galaxies, and the galaxies are far enough apart we get a clear view of the heavens.
Well, what about our sun? Is there something unique about the sun that we have in our solar system?
Yes. I mean, the sun is remarkably stable in its luminosity, which is crucial for us to be able to have civilization. And for 60 years, my colleagues have been looking for an exact enough twin of the sun that they say maybe there could be a planet with advanced life on it. They've yet to find one.
They haven't found one. We're the only one?
We found stars that are twins of one another, but we can't find a sufficient twin of the sun that it could be a candidate.
Stephen Hawking just died. He he didn't believe in a lot of these things. What was wrong with him?
Well, I got a whole chapter in Stephen Hawking.
Yeah.
We're actually giving that chapter 12 away for free for anybody who wants it.
Okay.
Just go to our website, reasons.org/cc. They can get that chapter for free.
Well, give
but,
us a couple.
You know, I got to hear him when I was at Caltech. Yeah, he spent a month out of every year at Caltech. A remarkable man. But also, he showed some humility. He said, you know, you all think I'm so brilliant. I've got an advantage over all of the rest of you at Caltech. I can't play golf. I can't fish. I can't hike. All I can do is theoretical physics. So he says, that's why I've been able to achieve, because I'm not distracted.
Well, was he that smart or was he that stupid because of
fools? Well, he was that focused. I mean, there's plenty of physicists and astronomers that are as and brilliant as he is, but he was singularly focused.
Yeah.
And he made some remarkable discoveries. In fact, he was the one, along with Roger Penrose, that came up with the first of the space-time theorems, which shows that there must be a causal agent beyond space and time that created everything. Now, he didn't believe the implications of that, but he was the one who actually said, when he was interviewed by the Reader's Digest, we proved that time is a beginning. We proved that time was created.
And there had to be a causal agent outside of
exactly.
Time.
And that's what's unique about the God of the Bible. The gods of the other religions create within space and time. The God of the Bible creates independent of space and time. And now we've got theorems that actually prove that.
Had you ever figured out why God wants to fool with us? I mean, I talked to him. And I said, you know, why do you want to fool with me? I mean, I'm one of umpteen billion people on this planet, and I'm the tiny little globe I'm on. Why does God want to fool with us?
He's got a purpose for you. This isn't going to be your final career.
Right.
I mean, I tell believers,
yeah,
God's got a career for you in the new creation. And it's more than anything you can imagine. It's going to have incredible significance. You're going to be a teacher and a ruler over the angels themselves and over everything else God creates. God is exposing us to his grace. The angels watch the grace of God. We experience the grace of God. So this life, as brief as it is a training ground for a remarkable career that we're going to have in the new creation.
It leads to a great deal of humility, though, doesn't it? As human beings, I mean, the fact that but we're special, again, it's kind of hard to understand why we would be special in the midst of this huge, huge universe. But he says, I've created all the things. Heaven is my throne, earth is my footstool. You know.
Well, I think when you look at the universe, you're forced to the conclusion we must have incredible value in God's sight. The fact that he created all of this so that we could exist and be, you know, have this training that we need to fulfill our future career.
When Einstein came up with his theory of relativity, how does that impact what we're talking about? Is there anything about what he found that's contrary to a theistic interpretation of this?
Not at all. In fact, these space-time theorems I'm talking about, they're based on the theory of general relativity. If general relativity reliably describes the movements of bodies in the universe, then there is a beginning to space and time and a creator of space and time. And today, as I talk about in this book, general relativity now ranks as the most exhaustively tested and best proven principle in all of physics. Therefore, the God of the Bible indeed exists.
How did Einstein come up with this? He's like a postal clerk over in Germany. How does he come up with these things?
Well, he was trained in physics.
Was he trained?
He was trained in physics. Yes, he was working for the patent office in Switzerland. But all on the side, he was working on this physics theory. And one personality he had great audacity. And says, yes, this is what the physics community is saying, but this is what I think the physics is saying. And he first came up with this theory of special relativity, which doesn't take a whole lot of brilliance. It's a rather simple thing to derive.
All right.
His general relativity was a remarkable achievement.
And why is that?
Well, it's much more challenging to develop that. In fact, when he first came up with it, the British mathematician, Sir Arthur Eddington, said there's only two people in the world understand general relativity, and I'm not sure about the other guy. But today there's about 10,000 that understand general relativity.
Well, he was looking for a unified space theory, wasn't he? Incorporated time into the other.
Right, and we've made some progress towards that. But in order to really get a firm handle on a unified field theory, mm-hmm. you need a particle accelerator 40 trillion miles long. And my colleagues joke that won't be funded until the Democrats control all branches of the government.
40 trillion.
40 trillion miles long. So yeah, chances are we're never going to have a unified field theory that we're confident
about. It won't happen. This book, ladies and gentlemen, is called Creator of the Cosmos. It was set up in like a textbook, wasn't it? I mean, it looks like it was set up for teaching people.
Well, there are study questions at the end of each chapter because we know small groups are going to want to go through this book. But it's mainly a book that believers can give to their non-Christian friends. We've seen more people come to faith in Christ through reading this book than any other book I've ever put out.
There's no conflict between true science and faith, is there, that you can see?
Well, that's how I came to faith. It was through my physics and astronomy that I realized the Bible indeed is the inspired word of God. And yeah, I was at age 19. I gave my life to Christ through signing my name in the back of a Gideon Bible. But it was based on 2 years of comparing what the Bible said about science and realizing
it's
the same thing.
The Bible is more valid than the theory of thermodynamics or any of these other theorems.
What brought me to Christ was realizing that the Bible had a higher degree of reliability and trustworthiness that we could show through mathematics and what I could see in, say, the second law of thermodynamics. I said, I trust that law, therefore I have to trust what the Bible's got to say.
The book is called Creator. Where can they get this? Is this available wherever?
The Creator and the Cosmos, yes, you can get it on Amazon. You can get it from us at Reasons to Believe.
Right.
So any online thing will have that.
You know, we have a School of Divinity at Regent University, and I didn't want those people, those students, to come out with that so-called creation science that is so flawed. And I wanted to make compulsory a course on cosmology. And you're active, and could you tell us about that?
Well, thanks to you, I'm going to be giving 7 lectures here in the next few days to various groups here at Regent University. And yeah, it's a thrill to be partnered with Regent. So
well,
thank you for making
you
that happen.
Is it helpful to the student? I mean, you know, this creation science just doesn't have it, does it? I mean, it's so full of
holes. We're talking about real creation science.
Yeah, real creation.
You know, God gave us 2 books, the book of nature and the book of scripture. And the book of nature brings us to the book of scripture. So that's mainly what I'm going to be speaking to your students and faculty about this week.
Well, I appreciate you and the tremendous wisdom that God has placed in your hand. This book is mind-boggling at the complexity of all the universe that Hugh was just talking about and the evidence for God in the universe that surrounds us. So thank you so much. God bless
you. You're welcome.
Appreciate it.